from WNYC New York Public Radio. This is the podcast of The Leonard Lopate Show. This is just one segment of the program. You can hear all Leonard's interviews on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
The Supreme Court has been on everyone's mind this past week. Joining me now is Federal Judge Robert L. Carter, who, during his long career as an NAACP attorney, argued 22 cases before the High Court and won all but one of them. His most famous case, undoubtedly, was Brown versus the Board of Education, which promised integrated public schools. Judge Carter reexamines that case and the continuing struggle to integrate public education in his autobiography, A Matter of Law. It's published by the New Press, and I'm pleased and honored that it brings Judge Robert Carter to my show today. Hello. Most of us associate Thurgood Marshall with the Brown v. the Board of Ed case. Wasn't he the head of the NAACP when the Supreme Court heard that case?
Well, he wasn't the head of the NAACP.
The legal.
He was the chief of head of the legal department.
So
I was one of his. I was his chief assistant.
And so, how did that work? Did he argue the case, or did you argue the case?
I argued the way that it worked was that I was given the task of arguing the merits of the Brown case, and I did, and he argued some of the other areas. There were five cases put together under the rubric of Brown, and what we did was that we had the merits of it in terms of the case, and then there were some other questions with other bits, and I was given the task of arguing the merits of the case.
Hadn't you written a first draft of a brief challenging school segregation as a violation of the 14th Amendment as early as 1946?
Well, what happened in that case was that there was a case in California in which they had segregated all the people on the basis of being Spanish-speaking, on the basis of the fact that they could educate Earl better. And the district court found that to be in violation of the 14th Amendment. And
but you could have been argued that was separate but equal.
Yeah. But we filed a brief amicus, and what I tried to get the court to do was to find that segregation itself was unconstitutional, but it wouldn't go that far.
You wound up one of your the important strategies was to include Kenneth Clark's psychological research as part of the argument in Brown versus the Board of Education.
Absolutely.
Why was Kenneth Clark's research so important?
Clark's work was so important because of the fact that what we had to show was that the separate but equal doctrine did not provide equality. And so what we had to show was that segregation itself was a violation that was denied equality to blacks and people that was put aside, that it wasn't a benign thing. It was hurtful and harmful.
Because it sent the message to blacks that they were inferior because they had to be separated from white students.
Yes.
And one of the problems you must have faced is that the Supreme Court, why don't you put on the headphones? That probably will allow you to hear me better. The Supreme Court is usually reluctant to go against precedent, isn't it? Although in the case of Plessy versus Ferguson, which established separate but equal, that was 1898. So that was pretty old.
1896, but it was okay.
Did you think that the Supreme Court might have been more open to rethinking this? How many years later? Almost 60 years later.
Well, what we showed the Supreme Court was that Plessy versus Ferguson was decided in railroads, a railroad case, and here we were with a case involving education, and we told the court that the Supreme Court had never determine whether or not Plessy versus Ferguson applied to education. had never done that, never examined that, never evaluated that. And so we asked the court in Brown, now is the time for you to look at it, evaluate it, and make the determination that Plessy does not apply to education. And that's what they did.
Now, did you feel that you were given the credit you deserved by Thurgood Marshall for your contribution to that?
Well, it wasn't a question of my Thurgood Marshall. It was a question of the fact that most of the people, the work that was done, assumed it was Marshall's, and although I had done it, and I was not aggressive at the time, and it really didn't bother me for a while, and it only began to bother me afterwards, and then I decided I was going to assert the fact of what I had done.
Well, he's become almost iconic in many people's minds,
yeah. But
you present a less than flattering portrait of him. An important figure, but someone with some clay feet.
Well, I thought that in my book, I showed some of the things about Marshall, but in the final analysis, I thought that Marshall was a big figure. I don't think I brought him down at all.
Well, you had a break in your working and personal relationship after 12 years of working together.
Yeah, we had a break in our relationship, and I think what I said in my book, that I was very annoyed. I thought that what he'd done was bad after all the work I had done, what she got credit for. But it seemed to me, as I rethought it, that what he'd done for me was that he had allowed me room and encouragement to grow. And that's all that I thought that he owed me.
Well, you did have a lot in common. You both attended Lincoln University in Chester, Pennsylvania. Both graduated from Howard Law School, and both got involved in the fight for equal rights.
Yes.
You said that Thurgood Marshall's personality made him well-suited to become a civil rights leader.
A leader, yeah.
You were a bit more reserved?
Yeah. I never tried to be a leader. My role, happily wrote, was more like a technocrat. I wanted to be a top lawyer, but I didn't want to be a leader. I thought that wasn't a leader. You know, I have to move people and so forth and so on. That's not my role.
So when Thurgood Marshall was named to the Supreme Court, you wouldn't have had even a little thought in the back of your head, gee, I wish that were me?
Well, of course. You know, anybody wants... It would be very nice to have been named to the Supreme Court, but I was not politic. Thurgood was very good about that, and he knew exactly where he was going. And he had the charisma and so forth to get that.
How effective do you think he was as a Supreme Court justice?
I think that he was a very effective one as Supreme Court. He was as effective as he was as a lawyer. What he did... What Thurgood did, he knew where he wanted to go and so forth. He had people to do his work on the Supreme Court as he had people to do his work when he was a lawyer.
Well, I'm sure you said you would have loved to have been named to the Supreme Court. Do you think you're on President Bush's current list of candidates?
As a matter of fact, I'm 88 years old, and you don't name anybody Supreme Court that late.
I think if you were 58 years old, you would not be on the list. Judge Robert L. Carter has written a memoir of struggle in the cause of equal rights called A Matter of Law. It is published by the New Press. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. Have you thought about how much the court has changed over the years since the one that decided in Brown versus the Board of Education?
Oh, of course. The change is such that I won 21 cases out of 22. I'd probably be before this court. And the change, I probably would have won maybe at best one case. The atmosphere has changed. The court has changed. It's entirely changed.
What was the case that you lost? Did you think that you had a strong case?
It was a case involving three soldiers who in Guam who had been accused of rape of a white woman and were sentenced to execution.
And you suggest here that you think they were railroaded.
Oh, yes. I didn't believe that they were guilty.
Does it matter to you in... I mean, now you're a judge, so it's a whole other matter. But when you were a lawyer, did it matter to you whether your clients were guilty or not guilty of what they were charged as in the merits of a case that you were on?
I think the only criminal case I ever tried was the one that I lost. And I avoided them for... All my cases were civil cases, for the most part. I avoided criminal cases. And after the one I lost, it hurt me so much that I stayed away from criminal cases.
In today's Times, there are a number of articles about the court, and one of them has to do with activist judges. I don't know if you saw that. And it turns out that Clarence Thomas has voted more against congressional acts than any other member of the Supreme Court, a lot more than Antonin Scalia, who I think is the third most likely to vote against a congressional act. What do you think about that? What do you think about the court today? Are the conservatives the real activists on this court, as that article suggests?
Well, my feeling about that's a misnomer. All the judges on the Supreme Court are activists. Anytime that they decide a decision, when they decide a matter interpreting the Constitution, they're activists. And
But aren't they just supposedly basing it on the law and on the facts of the case?
Well, everybody says that. But the point about it is they're interpreting the Constitution. And whatever you say, you know, this is on the law, that's nonsense. What you're doing is that you're interpreting a part of the Constitution. And you may have something that you say, you know, I'm closer to the law and blah, blah, blah. But I think that's nonsense.
What is your assessment of Justice O'Connor's years on the court? Most people are praising her as being a voice of moderation.
I was not a fan of Justice O'Connor. She was fairly well. She was good on feminine issues, but she was terrible on race questions. Not very good, and I had no, all this business about her, I don't buy.
What about your own past? You came from a rather poor background. Had you always wanted to be a lawyer?
No. As a matter of fact, law was the last thing I had in mind because I thought to be a lawyer you had to have a good voice. And you have to have charisma and so forth. Here I am, you know, sort of retired guy. And I didn't feel that I would make a good lawyer. But then I found out that I could be a good lawyer because what I had to do as a good lawyer was to know my facts, know my law, and that was that, and the law. So I didn't have to have a great voice and so forth because I could still be a lawyer without that.
Well, what did you think you would do with your law degree? You went into the Army, and that changed everything. But what did you think you'd do with your law degree if you hadn't gone into the Army?
I would have, before I went into the Army, I had a master's in law. And I thought, well, when I'm coming out, I'm going to finish part of my doctorate. I was going to get a doctorate in law and end up in the academy. I felt like that's where I would go.
And then you went into the military.
I went into the military, and I faced so much vicious discrimination. And the fact that being black was, at that time, was you were treated incessantly as if you were nothing. And so I said, I'm not going to go into the atmosphere of the academy. What I need to do is to fight discrimination, and that changed my whole approach to life.
You were discharged because you refused to obey orders.
Well, that's not that. That was so they trumped up a charge with me. What it was they thought that I was more radical, and I was not. I'm very moderate, actually, except on race, I suppose. And what they did, for some reason, they set me up to put me in the charge of this robot guy, a Martinet, and when I refused to obey every stupid order that he had, they had me set up. And what they did, what it came out was that I was an officer, and they gave me a discharge was less than honorable, but what it was merely broke me down to the fact that I was available to be drafted into be sent in the army again as a private.
Well, you enlisted the help of the dean at Howard Law School, right, at the time, and then started. How did you go from? Did that then radicalize you, as you suggest, at least in terms of race? Is that what led you to join the NAACP?
Yeah, no question.
Brown versus the Board of Education wasn't the first anti-segregation case you argued before the Supreme Court. The first one involved a student at the University of Oklahoma. What was that about?
That was a guy who was, let me see, what's the name of the case? You got the name of the case up there?
I wrote it down, but I don't have it in front of me.
Well, the case involved a man, let me see if I can think of it, Mike Lauren, University of Oklahoma. And what they had done was that they had, in order to evade having it set aside, they allowed this man to take the same courses, same classes, same professors as whites, but he had to sit in a separate seat, separated in the classroom. In the lunchroom, he had to sit at a separate chair, separate, and so forth. And when I took the case, we argued that his separation from his fellow students interfered with his ability to have intellectual intercourse, and therefore it was denied equal protection. And the Supreme Court, that's the basis for the decision.
Wasn't it actually a good strategy to go after segregation in education at the university level, because because it would be very expensive for universities to create duplicate medical schools, law schools? Integration just would be economically more feasible.
That was exactly the strategy, and that's why it was done. It was started at that level, because of the fact that at that time, and even now, you've got a few blacks who are going to go to the university level in these various schools. So you're going to set up a separate school for them? It's not economically feasible.
So that didn't lead to the immediate integration of universities.
What it led to was that the segregation was eliminated at that level. And only down, the university found all kinds of means to eliminate segregation at that level, at the university level. But then our theory was that if it's a university, if it's not, you don't have segregation there, why do you have segregation lower down?
But we had integration of universities in the 60s, many years later, with federal troops called out, and James Meredith and all of that. So it didn't apply to other universities, or were Mississippi and Alabama all just ignoring a Supreme Court decision?
Well, I think what was occurring, like in Mississippi, there had been no, until Meredith, there had been no blacks who to apply to the school or go get into the school.
They understood that it wasn't wise for them to apply.
This was the first time that they did that. So, you know, when there's a first time making a change, it's always tough.
My guest is the Honorable Robert L. Carter, United States District Judge in the Southern District of New York. From 1945 to 1956, he served as Assistant Special Counsel for the NAACP, and from 1956 to 1968, he served as General Counsel. Judge Carter is a graduate, as I said, of Lincoln University and Howard Law School. He's written an autobiography called A Matter of Law, a memoir of struggle in the cause of equal rights. It has a preface by John Hope Franklin, and it is published by the New Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Judge Robert L. Carter, who's written an autobiography called A Matter of Law, a memoir of struggle in the cause of equal rights. It's published by the New Press. So we were seeing these precedents in the 60s where people were willing, were applying to schools that had been segregated until then. Why were they more willing to try to integrate these schools than their parents had been? Had the atmosphere in the country changed enough so that a James Meredith might even consider doing something like that?
Well, I think what you have to bear in mind is that slavery was only ended in 1865. And my parents were the first of the blacks to be born free. So My parents, maybe 10, 15 years beyond me, means about, I'm 88 now, it's less, well, almost 100 years.
And their parents remembered slavery, or had been slaves.
No, my parents were the first born. Their parents had been slaves. And so during that period of time, the people who had been slaves had been denied the right to read, write, or learn anything. And the parents of the slaves, they had all this to catch up with. They had to learn to read and some education and all that sort of business.
Where did you grow up?
I was born in Florida, but I was only there for 6 weeks, and I spent the rest of my life in this area. In New Jersey and New York.
So do you think that living in this area has exposed you to less racism than if your parents had stayed in the South?
Yes, I marginally so. There's a lot of racism here, but the point is it's not as rigid. And so within the racism that exists, you particularly in cities, you're given the opportunity to develop.
Well, you talk about you and your wife having some bad experiences living briefly in Washington, D.C., the capital of the country, but also a city that was segregated for until fairly late.
Yeah.
And you were forced to stay in a substandard hotel in Topeka, Kansas, while you were working on the Brown versus the Board of Education case because you were black?
Mm-hmm. Because they had segregation at the time.
But Kansas was not a southern state.
Well, they segregated. At the time, there was segregation, and we were not able to stay in the downtown hotel. Wait a minute. Let me tell you. Newark, New Jersey was not a southern state, and Newark, New Jersey had segregation for a while. Blacks could not sit in the theaters with the rest of the people, with white people. They had to sit upstairs for a period of time, and that's in New Jersey.
And now Newark has had probably more black mayors than any other city in America. You've said that you lost some of your enormous respect for the U.S. Supreme Court after it issued a ruling in 1955 about how the Brown decision should be implemented.
Yes.
What had you imagined would happen?
Well, the reason I lost my respect for the Supreme Court and that's that decision was because of the fact that that's the first decision that the Supreme Court had ever issued, and I don't think it's issued one like it since, where if you are declared to have a constitutional right, you are not able to vest it immediately. They vested this with blacks in all deliberate speed. First time they've done that, and that's only because they were black.
And they were trying to appease
the Southern whites.
What do you think an all deliberate speed means? That could mean 6 months, and that could mean 60 years,
yeah,
couldn't it?
Yeah. But whatever it meant, if the fact that it was not vested immediately made it, for me, a racist decision.
Did in the end, does it really matter? Do you think that there'd be more integration today if all deliberate speed hadn't been added to that decision?
I really don't know.
Because the country has changed a lot, although you did say just about 10 years ago that more black children go to segregated schools today than they did in 1954.
Well, that's in the central cities and big cities where blacks are concentrated in the ghettos. And that's true. Blacks more blacks, or at least as many blacks, are in segregated schools as there were in the South in the dual school system.
And that's just simply going to the school in your district.
Mm-hmm.
That's just because you go to the school in your district.
That's because of the fact that you have neighborhood school programs, and because of the fact that with housing, blacks are concentrated. And what occurs is that the school authorities could find ways and means to have integration, but they don't make any effort to do that for the most part.
But you also seem to suggest that the old racial ideas persist at the highest levels of power despite all of the inroads that blacks have made since the 50s.
Well, the point that I'm making is that I don't believe that that this country has given up white supremacy. And it is still wedded to the idea of white supremacy and black subordination in large part. Marginally, things are better. But that concept has not changed.
How did that affect your approach to the bench? Did you see yourself as somebody who should redress those problems on a personal level?
I'm not sure I understand. On the bench?
Well, when you were serving and a case came before you and you... No.
When a case comes before me, I try to make a decision based on what I understand to be the law.
You were appointed to the Federal District Court in New York by President Nixon,
right?
A Republican. You're a Democrat. And that was not unusual. In fact, Bill Clinton named any number of Republicans to the bench as well. Things have changed during this Bush administration. Is that a break with precedent, or were those other times just an atypical bipartisan times?
Well, I think that... Clinton made every effort to be sure that the men and women that he named to the bench would be people that would not cause controversy. So he didn't name many liberals to the bench, or leftists, let's say. And that is not so true of the president, but a conservative president, because he does seek to name real conservatives that cause the Democrats to cry foul.
Actually, your problems came from unexpected places. Adam Clayton Powell didn't support an appointment to the bench.
Well, Adam Clayton Powell indicated to me, that he wasn't going to. Well, let me put it this way.
This was in 1961, before Nixon appointed.
When it was evident, or rather appeared as if I was going to get an appointment, I went to him, and he intimated to me that he would give me support for a fee, and I wasn't prepared to do that.
So when he was censured by the House, there probably were good reasons for that.
Yeah.
You got your revenge in an odd way, didn't you?
Well, when he was censored by the House, or they wanted to censor him, whatever, I was called back from, I was in Barbados with my wife, and I was called back, and I came and I represented him before the committee, and succeeded in getting him free of the censure. And when it was all over, and we were in his office, and everybody was around, pressing him for, you know, the lawyers for the money, for fees and so forth, I went up to him quietly and said, "What I do for you is free." And
do you think he got the message after he'd asked you?
Of course not. He didn't care. Uh-huh. I got the message.
And that was a matter of you it was maintaining your own sense of integrity.
He was, Adam was too self-centered to care. He didn't give a doggone one way or the other. But I got my little revenge.
The other day we talked with someone about the disproportionate number of blacks in America's prisons. When you were sitting as U.S. District Judge in the Southern District of New York and black defendants came before you, was that a concern? Let's say it was a cocaine case. You had a white defendant, a black defendant. Were you able to send him to jail for the same amount of time?
Of course. I refused to, for people in the same amount of time, I would always sentence them to the same.
But why do you think that doesn't happen all that much in the courts, and that's with black judges as well as white judges?
Well, there are not that many black judges, and the point about it is that white judges now and white people now are unable to see black people as being some of the same as them. White judges give harsher sentences to blacks than they did to whites. They give less opportunities to blacks than they did to whites. It's across the board. And it's because of the separation that we have in this country.
But it's been so long, and so many of our heroes are black. Our sports heroes, our entertainment heroes. There are great artists. So the culture has been so affected by the African-American influence, the African-American input, you would think by now those attitudes would have changed. And schools have been segregated all throughout the country. A lot of white kids grow up best friends with black kids.
Well, I see, I'm not white, so I'm not in the position to say why it's changed. Blacks can't change it. The question is this is a white problem, more than a black problem in terms of what you're talking about.
There are many people in the African-American community who don't want to see complete integration. They feel uncomfortable with the idea of total integration.
There may be a few people like that, but they only feel uncomfortable about it because they feel that they're not wanted. I think that everybody in this country deep down wants to live their lives and people together. But somehow we all have these feelings about race, about color, and stuff that interferes.
Didn't you work for a time in a corporate law firm?
Yeah.
Were you aware of racism there?
In the law firm? Of course not. Not in the confines in which I was working, of course not. They wouldn't have taken me in if there had been anything like that. Just, you know, when you're working with whites and blacks are working together and anything, they tend to forget the whole issue of race and color.
Are you still on the bench?
I'm on the bench. I take cases from time to time, yes.
No, but that's not the same as sitting regularly. No, but it's not the same as retirement either.
I'm not an active, what they call an active judge. I take cases when I want to and so forth. I take time out and write my book and things like that.
Do you find that young black lawyers want to be mentored by somebody like you? Do people come to you for advice?
Yes. Yes.
You hesitated. I wonder why you hesitated.
I hesitated because I was trying to think through. They're not knocking down the door. But from time to time, they do, come talk to me about various things.
Still, you must be very proud of your achievement. America has changed an awful lot. And you argued some of the most important cases to have changed America in that regard.
Yeah. I've had an interesting life and probably an unusual one. And probably more interesting than many people have the opportunity. So I'm very grateful for that.
And many people will be surprised at just how candid this book is. You pulled no punches. And that was part of the pleasure for me in reading it. The book is A Matter of Law, a memoir of struggle in the cause of equal rights, written by Judge Robert L. Carter, with a preface by John Hope Franklin, and it is published by the New Press. I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for checking out today's podcast of The Leonard LoPage Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.